Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 122, a special episode where we take a reflective look at the roles and challenges of maintaining our professional domains of knowledge in today's digitally enabled world. To help us, we read an article titled Evidence in Management and Organizational Science, Assembling the Field's Full Weight of Scientific Knowledge Through Synthesis by Denise Rousseau, Joshua Manning, and David Denyer, published in 2008 in the Academy of Management Annals. To learn more, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, everyone. This is Pedro coming to you from a tropical storm day in Brazil.
Hi, this is Sarah from London and in the UK.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. And welcome to the first episode of our 10th anniversary year. This is incredible. I mean, it's the podcast has been going for now about 9.5 years. We're going to celebrate the actual birthday this forthcoming October. But we decided to make this a year-long celebration and do some things during the course of the year that highlight not just us as a podcast, but also the state of organization studies, what has occurred over the course of time. And this particular episode is going to focus on one aspect, and that is the organization of knowledge and how much the body of knowledge that we have on organization studies is just continuing to expand in astronomic proportions, which is a great thing. We should be something that we should be celebrating. But there are some downsides. And I think we've hinted at some of the downsides here and there as we went through episodes over our many years. But we thought we would tackle some of these issues a little bit more intentionally and then tell you what we're going to be doing about it, which is going to come to you in part two, which will be released very, very soon. And now we're going to use our own program as a microcosm, as an example. This is episode 122, which means that we have covered over 100 classic works of organization studies and some other topics. But the older stuff that we have is rather buried in our website. And you go across all other podcasts or whatever, it takes effort to try to find the older stuff that you posted. And for us, because we're in the business of presenting knowledge from a timelessness perspective, that is, all of the articles and episodes that we're doing are sort of equal in weight. And so we really believe it's important that, you know, if we're talking about one particular topic, we want to emphasize, hey, here are some other related episodes we've done in the past. Here are the classics, but in a typical podcast format and think about it in journals, the old stuff gets buried. There's kind of that problem. There's also, everybody has a different idea of what the major theories are and what the intersection is between theories and all that sort of thing. But I remember as a doctoral student walking into my first class, being overwhelmed by the notion that there was no organization to it, that there was no easy way to navigate. What am I getting into? And so there's that. And then last, there's also just the natural brain drain as our more senior academics leave. To what extent does their contributions get forgotten and buried? And I have been in organizations where essentially it was almost systematic. It was just the natural thing that happened is that folks leave, what they contributed just gets forgotten, and it's all about who's presently in the organization. And so there's a recency bias in that regard that also comes into play. So with all of that, I've spoken a lot about what I think has been a challenge with understanding, appreciating, and ultimately utilizing our the expansive corporate base of knowledge. What do you think?
So maybe I'll just start by commenting a couple of things that you said, right? In terms of how the body of knowledge is organized, I think the challenge we also have is that there is no agreement on how should be the way to order that. And we are sympathetic to that challenge. But I think the point is that we want to strike the balance of, for example, always expanding the canon and being cognizant to the fact that there can be different ways to understand particular readings. That's why we have usually each episode is a dialogue, right? So we can represent different voices and make sense of that. But at the same time, find a way to make the content, to create a clearing through this forest of knowledge in which people can see what are these different perspectives and how they connect with each other, right? I think that's the other point that we try to do in the show. And as you know, you were mentioning, we're trying to maybe improve on that, is to showcase the connections so people can see how particular ideas are building on something, advancing, criticizing, and part of an ecology of ideas, right? And I think that is both some of the goals in doing what we do and in improving the way in which the knowledge that we have accumulated can be further arranged in a way that can be better utilized and discoverable by people.
I think it's very interesting and maybe telling about our own backgrounds, potentially, that the way you introduced it, Tom, today, I was hearing it as the role of an archivist or a librarian or a curator, as in a gallery, museum curator. But when Pedro first invited me to join the podcasting team, I always thought of it as a sort of teacher role, as the whole podcast series as a supplemental course for doctoral students, for faculty, and for interested audience. Hello, non-doctoral students and faculty, whoever may be listening today, a sort of top-up training in the classics or in the fundamental texts that you need for your current work and your current situation, but for whatever reason you might not have had previously. And that's how I have approached each episode that I've been invited to join and approach the preparation. But the other role, the curation, guide, historian, not gatekeeper in terms of letting people in and out, but the keeper of the material, is something I'd never thought of before. And I wonder whether it's just the magnitude of 10 years that is making you think like this, or whether you've always thought of it that way. Tom, I've never asked you.
Well, I can answer that based on my past experiences as a knowledge engineer, which is sort of lends me into the direction of being naturally a curator type of an individual. And I think you raise an excellent point that even it's not just that there's disagreements perhaps of how we understand the relationships and the connections in which we iron out a number of those differences during our dialogues, but it's also our orientations coming into the field. For me, curation is rooted in how do I help explain things to people? It's a very practitioner oriented. And so my contributions have always been kind of like, all right, how do I take the ideas that we're talking about and put them into practice? And how do I recall how do I store and therefore recall the information that I have collected over time so that I don't, you know, like when I talk about the brain drain and some of these other problems, I come from an environment where forgetting is a sin, whereas in other perspectives, forgetting is like, it's just part of the environment. Knowledge engineering was originally one of the subfields of artificial intelligence, and I was an artificial intelligence student in my master's. Now, this is about 35 years ago. It's fascinating to see a lot of what we were fantasizing about in those days that are coming true today. But that's the perspective that I bring in, how to encode, store, retrieve, and utilize so that as I'm dealing with questions of practice, I'm able to draw from a wide base of knowledge.
So it's interesting to see these conceptions, right, on the work of podcasting, because I usually think in terms of a message in a bottle, in trying to make the field discoverable. Certainly, of course, I think the goal is to make the knowledge available for people that already know of the field and are curious about a particular theory, concept, or idea. But because of the medium, which is one that is potentially Googleable, discoverable, findable in all sorts of platforms that are not just going to the library and going through books, but just, you know, putting a key concept or an author and coming up and discovering something, I think the idea is also to reach beyond. And therefore, how we have this body of knowledge that, you know, the person that whoever finds a particular episode or a particular part of the episode can then more easily navigate to understand what is this thing, right? Because I think that this subfield, unlike maybe if you were doing physics or history or any other thing that is widely popular known, is a bit niche. So there is also an element of being able to give a sense of what is this thing that you stumbled upon, right? And what it is made up and what are the parts and what else could be relevant for you to listen if you just found this kind of new genre of intellectual debate, which is organizational theory.
Well, the last words then being the first in mind of organizational theory. So again, that was one of the reasons that I started joining with you gentlemen on the podcast, was to shore up my background in org theory that was now clearly a part of my scholarly identity, but was not when I was a student and needed rebuilding from scratch. Again, the challenge or the provocation you gave us about the rapidly increasing amount of knowledge, which we haven't mentioned yet, one of our scaffolding pieces for this episode, but we did read a paper together, as we always do. And in that paper from 2008, they did mention the exponential expansion of knowledge products that are being created. So I can only imagine what word they would use now for 2024, and creators versus consumers is always a perennial tension in this profession. So again, thinking about the what is the responsibility or what are we doing to curate organizational memory or professional memory, and whether we're looking backwards too much, enough, looking forwards enough, and trying to balance all of that at the same time as contributing to some of that. And I think this is a fair tension throughout the profession, right? So there's the generation of new knowledge, there's this synthesis of knowledge from, and methods, definitely with methods from different fields into one's own practice. This is just generally trying to read and review and dot every I and cross every T before you then embark on your own project and your generation of your own data and the creation of a new piece that will then join all of that. I don't think the size of the problem is what I'm reacting to. I think it's more that what Tom was alluding to. I feel the responsibility of the problem. I feel the weight of the amount that's out there and what I should know and what I should get right and what I should include before. I think this is something where if you think about just one part of the research act, when you think about writing, there are some people who are complete outliners. This was the discussion that a couple of my colleagues had earlier this week. Do you outline? And to what degree do you outline before you set words to page for your first draft? And there are others who think that you learn through writing. You deepen your understanding by writing. You just get it all out and make sense of it later. And I think one of the things that stops all of us from moving faster in that part of the process is the sense of responsibility. You know, we are being asked to write this up for consumption by our colleagues, by our students, and by the public. So it does have that gravitas to it. And the size of the history that has come before means you just don't want to make a mistake, right? And that is also in the same essay that I hinted at.
That is a very excellent point. Just seeing, like with some of the classics, how many citations are among those classics? And then you get to your typical Academy of Management publication and you look at the reference section is written in smaller font and it covers about the same amount of paper as the article itself. I'm exaggerating, but you're right. I mean, when we talk about entering a complex space and the expectations we have that we put upon ourselves and that there is within the community, to be very, very clear and purposeful about where your your contribution is going to fit in this very complex and terrain is extraordinary, and we're all wrestling with it. There's also, how do you present this? Like, I'll ask Pedro this question, because you teach undergraduates. Sarah, I know you teach undergraduates. There's also the other problem of how do you present this complex terrain to newbies, whether it's undergraduates or new, you know, master's students coming in from a different discipline or whatever, without overwhelming them. I only have I don't work in the same kind of academia, so my experience is a little different.
So I'm not without sin here. And I think that one of the comments that my students would make of my course, which I do a introductory course about organizations for undergrads, is that there's always too much. And I think as I taught, I have learned to maybe reduce the number of concepts, right? But I still have so many examples and ideas and stuff I want to share because I'm such an enthusiast about this area that I always have too much, even if it's not too much concepts, too much examples, or too much whatever. But the only way I have found to tame myself, or to some extent to make it all more digestible, is to start from people's own experience. Because another challenge that comes from studying organizations is that it can feel detached, right? It can feel, voluminous, but also not transparently relevant. So I always start my course and the first workshop I do with the students about thinking about their daily experiences. And because we are all, you know, higher education, about the school we are in. So I try to explain to them how some of the process that they take for granted, like scheduling a class or an exam or whatever it is the product of many interdependencies, different roles that come together, people that are following different rules, but also the norms and the expectations that exist and the social interactions and the values that shape behavior. So I try to start from their own routines and then layer slowly different, in this case, elements of organizations that have a role to play to understand, in the case of my course, how behavior is shaped and shapes organizations. So that's my way to go about that. But in thinking about the text that we read, as Sarah was mentioning, which was a piece at the Academy of Management Annals by Denise Rousseau, Joshua Manning, and David Dinier, in which it's about evidence in management or organizational science, right? In which they talk about first diagnose the issue of so much knowledge that's not utilized and what can be done. And they talk about the potential relevance of more synthesis in a way to bring together the available knowledge and make it more consumable in the words that we are using here today. I think that one lesson that I took from reading that applies for us here is this idea that, yes, we have a responsibility in terms how we organize the knowledge and find a place for our contribution, but also recognizing that whatever contribution we have fits back on this river of knowledge. And we should not expect one paper, and that's what they say, to have the answer, but we should think more in terms of the collection of papers that may be able to say something about a particular topic, right? And especially in a time in which there is a very individualistic, narrow idea about quote-unquote impact, it's important to recognize that. And I think that another element of the podcast that have always been with us, and the reason why we focus on fundamentals, right, as Sarah was saying, is that we want to decenter a particular person, a particular author, a particular reading, and put that in context. So that's why we always start to go to what are some of the sources of a particular debate on a particular specialization and a particular conversation, and try to use that to think more in collective terms on what is the knowledge in that particular area or topic.
You say river of knowledge. I think the authors and I would say fire hose. I think just to expand on the discussion of how do you teach this to undergraduates, I don't think the level of instruction matters that much because most students are starting again. Certainly with some of the concepts in about research quality that we went through or we reminded ourselves in this annals piece, I think even an almost straight through student, so undergraduate to master's, even to PhD, would need these core concepts, reminding, expanding at your fingertips. And that's just the nature of the profession that we do. We are not just researchers, not just teachers, impact engagement professionals, fundraisers, public scholars, citizens. There's a lot of service that goes into it. Pastoral care, if you have pastoral care responsibilities in your role. So it's one thing to say, oh, how do you teach it to someone who's never seen it for the first time? It's not that they've never seen anything related to it at all for the first time. We might not call it epistemology. And certainly, you know, if I'm an external examiner and someone's assessment brief has explain your epistemology and your position on the study in, you know, worth 20 points. You just think, okay, that's an area for simplification, right? You don't need to call it epistemology to make your point. One thing that is common across all the levels is the need for someone to remind them on what is an absolute, what is a non-negotiable in that category, and what is a best practice that might have exceptions, right? I think that's something important as a teacher to shepherd the student populations that you have. I think one thing that is different between undergraduate and graduate, and all of my future students, I hope you are listening, and all of Tom and Pedro's students, I hope you're listening, is the anticipated degree of preparation. I think there's definitely a discussion in the profession that for many reasons, some of them personal, some of them economic, some of them sociological with demographic shifts, the expectation that students meet their commitments to outside of classroom preparation, you can't rely on that anymore. Even though every university system in the world talks about credit hours and how many in-class credit hours equate to how many out-of-class hours, homework, preparation, application of knowledge, the reality is that they don't do it. They don't do it. They don't do it before, and they probably don't do it after, unless indeed you have an exam or something. And this is the new reality that as instructors we have to face, right? So I think the difference then is you can hope and expect and reward a bit more preparation among your graduate students with the hope that they have had those few more working years where that is the norm. But woe betide any instructor who doesn't have a plan B, right?
Yeah, that's a great point. My environment's a little bit different because it's a professional education environment. So basically, I'm teaching practitioners. And the problem is really interesting in contrast, because unlike in a graduate setting where you're exposing a divergent array of information and allowing them to figure out their own synthesis, teaching practitioners tends to bring you to what you might either call a real wavetop sort of a, you know, here's some fundamental ideas to help you think about about the problems that you faced. And here is a model. Usually it's one model. It's rarely a comparison of models. But basically, you're looking for them to take a model and apply it. It's almost like a management consultant equivalent, where the consultant comes in, presents a model, adapts it to what a practitioner or an organizational setting needs to solve their particular problem. But you're not necessarily teaching a broad array or seeking synthesis. What you're seeking is a more practical outcome. So then the challenge that I have as an educator in that setting is, okay, how do I take this complexity of information and choose either the one model or a hybrid model as the thing to present? Because that's about the only opportunity I have to present on a particular problem domain. You see what I mean? It's a different approach, but it is very similar to what you were saying, Pedro, because the path to success begins with trying to situate the students, have the students bring their experiences to bear to, you know, make them understand why they're going to learn about a particular topic that they're only going to get in a few short hours or a couple of days or whatever. And that's going to be their experience in that particular topic area.
It almost sounds like you're trying to circumvent the expectation of a formula, right? That's the idea that you're talking about model and so on, and you're thinking about how you can go beyond just the formula, but also try to say people reason vis-a-vis the content and using the experience, but also seeing some plurality. And this is making me think again in the text that we read, because synthesis can mean many things. And of course, the authors talk about different ways to do synthesis, and they compare and contrast them according to some criteria, and at the end kind of suggest a multi-stage process of synthesis, and also talk about how this should be understood as a collective process by the community and so on. But one can think of the result, the output of a synthesis, almost like, you know, as if you boil the ocean into a little cube that has all of the flavor there. But we can also think of synthesis as a map, right? And I think that's what we are talking about here when we're talking about the organization of knowledge and the podcast and these accumulated episodes and texts that we have on the website and ways that we can think about making it easier to navigate, right? Which in this case is not so much what is the synthesis, meaning what is the insight that comes out of all of this conversation, but more about what is the way in which people can more easily make their own journey through all of this content, right? So to go back to what Sarah was saying, the sense of responsibility of what you present and how you present and what is available. So how do we organize the knowledge and the information in a way that it's easier for people to identify, to see, to chart the connections, to make sense of whatever exists in this particular area of research?
And maybe after 10 years of doing it and 122 episodes, we need a bit more of a dialogue than a one-way fire hose. So there are many ways to engage with us and to get in touch with us. And if there's something we're doing that you like, let us know. And if there's something you need that we are not doing, please also let us know. Not just suggestions for content, but process tools. There will be more coming out over the year. Watch what Tom has planned regarding tools and curation. But we're always interested if there are things that you need that we can do, right? Every teacher should be.
Let me go back to something you were saying, Sarah, too, because what you're talking about with expectations and that sort of thing, one of the factors that's clearly impacting the way that, say, the broad we, consume knowledge is the introduction of artificial intelligence tools that promise to make the ability to navigate this complex organization of knowledge that much easier. As part of my work, I did say I was an artificial intelligence student in the past, and I have also been interested in how some of these tools have come out. I'm not going to name any particular tools here, but let's just say that I've tried several, which range from those that are sort of like on the free, very popular, familiar types tools, where you can query about organization studies and get something back, to some that are designed specifically for organization scholars, where if you give a prompt and you get this long response with dozens or hundreds of references and that sort of thing. And so I've been playing around with them with some purpose of intent. But there are certainly some things that I've found that if, you know, first off, I recognize that there is a whole debate out there as to whether these are legitimate tools to use or not. I think what's emerged is a bit more of a, well, we have to deal with it. They're here. People are going to use them. So how do we get people to use them right? But one of the things that I have found in my own little bit of work, so consider this just anecdotal, is a recency bias. Like if you're going to query about stuff, obviously the AI is crawling the internet to see what is physically there. And it's going to tend to be what is the most recently published. So when I ask about or prompt about something on organization studies, I'll usually get back a lot of interesting information, but just about everything is dated from 2017 and later. And so I found it challenging to try to prompt it for going back to foundational texts, like the sort of queries we would expect to be making because we are focused on the classics. Yet I know that there are a lot of classics that we have covered in the program that are not readily available online. We've had to go find them. Even those that are in the public domain, because they're so old, are difficult to locate. So then the question becomes, is this a potential challenge? Like, if people are going to rely on these tools because it's quick, easy, whatever, but don't necessarily understand the broader knowledge base, well, are we potentially going down a dangerous road? I'll stop it with that.
So there is an interesting part of this, which is, of course, humans make the tools, at least for the time being. And humans teach the tools what is important and what to prioritize. So you could query, why has the tool been built in this way to prioritize the latest first? And I hear in what you're saying a sort of horrified reaction to the weighting of later works combined with the difficulty of catching up if you wanted to redress the imbalance. But I'll tell you an anecdote from when I was a doctoral student. So I went into my first supervisor's office and was super frustrated that I couldn't get a hold of certain sources that I were convinced were absolutely necessary to move on with the lit review, the first substantial submission for my PhD. And she looked at me and she said, "What are you trying to get a hold of?" So I showed her, and I showed her where, you know, where I couldn't get it and that they would have to physically order it from the British Library. And she said, "That's a book. Why are you looking for books?" She said, "Everything you need to do what we've asked of you to do this literature review at this stage of your PhD should be available in something that's 5 years or younger, or in a systematic review that links to the original source if you ever needed to justify your choice, but you can rely on the systematic review at this point in what you were doing." And I was horrified. I went home and said, "My teacher told me not to read books." You know, and now that I am now on the other side of the desk, as I like to call it, she was absolutely right. The amount of time I had available to draft and to look through what I needed to learn to then convey my own ideas, my unique interpretation, my piece that was going to advance the field, was limited and only needed to scaffold myself with the signals and the core pieces that the rest of the field needed to take me seriously. And I would always have time to go and find and read those books whenever I wanted, but that time wasn't now. And it took me a very long time, that was 17 years ago, it took me a very long time to appreciate what she was trying to teach me. And I bring it up here just to say that I too am horrified that we are not necessarily reading books. I too am horrified that books that are old enough to be in the public domain are still difficult to access and to feed into the tool that we are talking about. Let's call it tool with a capital T. But whether that is causing us a problem, whether it's impoverishing what that tool can do, whether it's the part of living with AI that we should be focusing on now, I think that's a different controversy and a different question.
So following on that, we can also think, following your, you know, thoughts, people design these tools and they have particular lay theories, ideas, expectations, visions, worldviews about what science is and what they're used for and what knowledge is counts or not. It might be that in some moments, that was the example that you gave, but it could also be that in some disciplines, spaces, the recent is what that matters, right? It could be that maybe imagine more paradigmatic sciences, right? If you're doing physics, you don't have to go back to Newtonian physics to answer whatever you're going to understand. And of course, these things are designed by usually IT professionals. We have their own set of ideas about knowledge. But social sciences, and at least our space in OT, is non-paradigmatic. And I think that what makes it a little bit unique is that understanding where ideas come from, it's important to understand the genealogy, to show respect, to understand what has been tried and how things fit. The usual way that I think about that is that ideas have parents. Of course, it's impossible to read everything. And one of the reasons I think that we all like the podcast so much and continue to do that is that we may have not read all that there is to read that is foundational. We are, you know, as we go in our careers and progress and learn, we are still learning about the fundamentals, because you're very correct that I think no PhD program or no informed reader or no person can know all that there is. But I think that the challenge is to not making visible the knowledge, right? There is one thing to be cognizant of the logistical limits and how one prioritizes one's time versus the value attributed to particular pieces, elements, books, whatever it is, and how we have to maintain their existence, at least, visible, right, for anyone that's interested in a particular area. That I think that it's what sparks to mind this, maybe not controversy, but observation that Tom brought up.
I do believe that the recency bias has another effect, which I think is really important to root out, that we have been fighting in this podcast, is that with recency bias, once, I'll call it a weird idea, you can take that as to whether or not that's good or bad, but something that is a little weird, once it enters the canon, then it's awfully difficult to overcome that. And we have found numerous instances in the podcast with the episode we did with Kurt Lewin or Kurt Levine, the episode on Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which Maslow himself did not create. We have found several instances where, going back to the foundational readings, uncovers some myths or exposes some myths that have crept in over time. And it's not to say that the myths are bad. I mean, I think there's utility in the reinterpretation of foundational texts as we grow this knowledge. I'm not saying that that's bad, but sometimes going back to the foundational reading, you may realize or come to uncover that somewhere there's been a departure from the original intent and a misinterpretation might have been introduced. I also think that sometimes there's just excitement and refreshment that goes back to looking at the original text. And I'm going to highlight our examination of the Peter Principle as an example of that one, because there's a phenomenon that everybody kind of knows about, but there's so much more that went into that book than just the principle that everybody knows about. And to understand the broader context of what went into the idea and the 200 other lemmas and axioms that were written into that book, it actually is expansive. So I suppose a part of this is how to cultivate the thirst to go back to the foundational readings, to cultivate the desire to look broader than what might be narrowly vital for the particular paper you're trying to write.
So as with all of these provocations, I suppose one way to understand the position is to push it to the extremes, right? So we could turn around and say, okay, Tom, if I buy that the reliance or the over-reliance on recent material is bad for knowledge curation, is bad for learning and the system, what is the utopia you would like us to aim at?
That's a terrific question. I can tell you what I would envision as the utopia, but it would probably not pass muster with a lot of with other perspectives. But to me, it begins with having the knowledge out there. And this is what falls on the librarian side of things, of course, is that what is considered foundational should be available. Whether it's curated or whatever. But there's also kind of like, the journey. Because I remember in my own doctoral program, when we started, everything was about the journey. And part of it was to try to encourage this idea of trusting the process of going through the doctoral journey. What I would love to be able to see is a way for this organization of knowledge to not appear to be so overwhelming, that there is there are ways of mapping the terrain. I know I like using that military metaphor. Of all of us have our own individual ways of organizing what we know, identifying what we don't know or whatever. But I suspect that not all of us know how to do that.
So from what you say, I feel that Utopia is almost like a great magazine store, right? That you go around and you have a sense that where the socks are and where are the winter jackets and where, household items are and why they are there, and it's easily, intuitive to navigate, and they are, wayfinding that allows you to go and get what you need and maybe also discover things that are unexpected, right? So it, in a way, is to make it discoverable and make it in a way that you cultivate, Schlubeck, you're saying that you can go to the particular thing that you want to get. And if you're, you know, zoom focus in a moment, but you are able to be aware all of the other things that are around it, right? So even though if you just go for the latest papers from the past 5 years, you understand at least that they are connected to other things, right? And that may be just something that you come back later. So that's how I understand a way in which we take in consideration the logistic limits that exist, but also strive to create space for people to continue to discover. I think that's where the idea of journey comes in, right? That it's a continuous process. Basically, I think we want to stimulate people to be curious, no matter if you are a researcher, a teacher, a student, an interested party, a practitioner, whatever, but to continue to be curious on this. The only challenge I think that I see is that with order, we may lose complexity and variety, which is something that we always debated, right? That's the danger of thinking about a canon, a classic, because it's always a contention on classic for whom, for in what time, to what audiences, which is something that we have always discussed in the podcast, that in trying to not just to showcase what is fundamental, but also to expand what is part of the canon. So I think that's the challenge here as well, is not just the logistic one of what is possible to be read now versus what ideally should be people could be familiar with, but also in creating the order in this fictitious department store that I'm imagining, that we are able to make it easy for people to navigate, but at the same time, building new wings into it and parts and expanding the catalog and recognizing there are different alternatives or variations on the particular piece that you're looking for, because there is plurality out there as well, right? And I think that is an open challenge for us all.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.